Birth and suffering are deeply linked concepts in Buddhism, and their connection has shaped how the bodies and status of women were understood. Join us today for a conversation with Amy Paris Langenberg on her book, Birth in Buddhism, The Suffering Fetus and Female Freedom, published by Routledge in their series, Critical Studies in Buddhism. Amy takes as her focus the Garbhavakranti Sutra, or Descent of the Embryo Scripture, a text from the early first millennium. Using this work as her point of departure and reading across a wide range of genres, Amy explores birth metaphors, the journey of the fetus, and the concepts of purity, auspiciousness, and disgust, showing how the Buddhist depiction of female bodies operated against a backdrop of earlier South Asian ideas. The Descent of the Embryo Scripture speaks to the human condition, but especially to the status of women, fertility, the female body, and mothers. Amy argues that this Buddhist depiction of women's bodies as disgusting and impure opened the way for new female roles. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies. I'm Natasha Heller, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Amy Paris Langenberg about her new book, Birth in Buddhism, The Suffering Fetus and Female Freedom. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. I'm wondering if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in Buddhism.
Sure, yeah. So it's sort of lost a little bit in the mists of history, but I really got first interested in India, not really Buddhism per se, but really India. As a college student, I participated in the College Year in India program, which is kind of a famous program. I was in Varanasi, Benares, as a student, and I didn't study Buddhism. I studied Hindi and I studied Kathak dance, believe it or not. And I did some field work actually on traditional midwifery. There's a bit of a through line there, I think. And, you know, I spent some time in some of the Tibetan areas of India, Manali and Dharamsala. And so I kind of crossed paths with things Tibetan and things Buddhist. But, you know, I was really a Benares gal. I was very fascinated by the interpenetrating religious worlds of Benares. So then I did actually end up going back to India after college and on a undergraduate fellowship to study traditional medicine, in particular Tibetan medicine. So I'd gotten a little closer to Buddhism at that point, and I did spend more time in the Tibetan areas and crossed paths quite a bit, actually, with the Dalai Lama, as as it would happen, including actually went to one of the early Kalachakra initiations in Bodh Gaya when it was still actually a kind of dusty, sleepy town. So I got you know, a little bit closer to Buddhism, but I was still really mainly interested in the religious worlds of India. So, and I think that's probably that beginning probably explains some of my insistence on treating Buddhism really as an Indian religion. And, you know, I'm really most interested in Buddhism in its South Asian context and looking how it's really embedded in this really complex religious environment. So that's how I started. I did eventually end up in a religion PhD program at Columbia with a focus on Buddhism. And my advisor was Robert Thurman. And of course, his major focus is Tibet. But even then, I remember coming in and sort of on day one saying to him, but, you know, I want to study India. And he was, you know, he was fine with that. He said, oh, that's fine. And I remember really vividly, actually, he made this gesture of sort of placing something on his head and a gesture of respect, you know, the way you'd sort of place an image on your head and touch your forehead to it. He did that. So he was kind of miming how the Tibetans revere India. But, you know, Bob, I think, was really, he's really interested in India, but he really is someone who reads Tibetan texts and is really immersed in the Tibetan world. So I kind of found my way to Sanskrit Buddhism on my own, sort of in that context in Columbia. But I think I've gotten more and more attentive to the larger Buddhist world as I've especially moved out of my dissertation work, which is, you know, quite a few years ago now, and especially spending time in the classroom with undergraduates. So I've become really increasingly interested in other Buddhist worlds, especially all of the sort of many faces of Buddhist monasticism, and also Buddhist modernism and especially Buddhist feminism. So my interests definitely have developed and grown, but I would say my heart is still in South Asia.
That's fascinating. I'm actually really interested to learn that you had this early interest in midwifery and medicine, because I think that comes out very clearly in the book, and what is one of the most fascinating elements of your work. So actually, that was a good pivot to the book itself. I wonder if I can ask, what drew you to the Descent of the Embryo scripture, the Garbhavakranti Sutra? Could you give us some background on the text and why you became interested?
Yeah, sure. So another pretty convoluted story, of course. So it actually came out of a text that we read at Columbia again, that I read with Bob in our Tibetan reading class, and which was all graduate students. And Bob used to select a text each semester that he thought one or the other of us would be interested in. And when it sort of came to be my turn, he selected a text, a Tibetan text by Desi Sangye Gyatso called the Baidurya Limbo, which is actually it's a medical commentary on the Gishi, which is the main, you know, medical text of Tibet. And in particular, of course, he selected the embryology chapter. He knew I was interested in, he knew I was interested in gender. He knew I was interested in medicine, and he knew I'd done this work on midwifery. So he selected that chapter. And yeah, of course, it's fascinating. It's weird. There's a lot of medical detail, the stages of embryological growth, how to change the embryo from a girl to a boy. A lot of the same stuff, actually, that's in my text. And anyway, as we were reading this text, I noticed that Desi Sangye Gyatso referenced or referred to this other text, the sutra text, which was the Garbhavakranti Sutra, that's the Sanskrit reconstruction of the name, a lot, right? He really relied on that text. And so when it came to selecting a dissertation topic, I remembered that and I went looking for it. And I really, again, I wanted something that was Indian, not Tibetan. And so I went back to it and looked up that sutra and read it. And the more I read it, the more interesting it became to me. And I also realized that the more I read it, I realized that it really wasn't a medical text per se, although it kind of used this medical idiom, right? But really it was a text about gender and suffering and freedom and about some really core issues in Indian Buddhism. So it ended up being a really rich text to work on.
Right. It's certainly fascinating in the book. And one thing I wanted to raise was actually in your introduction, you start with the contemporary period. And you start by talking about the positive changes in the situation of Buddhist women. And so I wanted to, you know, since you opened that way, I wanted to ask, as we look at how this sutra in its sort of South Asian context, how did your thinking about the Buddhist present shape what you were doing with the text?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Not in any direct way, but you're absolutely right. The contemporary nuns movement is really in the background of this project. I think the connection for me, it's really more of a kind of theoretical methodological connection. So as I talk about it, the first pages, just the very first couple of pages of the introduction, that if you spend time, for instance, at Sakyadita conferences, so that's an international women's organization that meet their conferences every couple of years, and you get to know a lot of monastic women from all over the Buddhist world. And it becomes very clear that what women want for themselves is different in different contexts, and that although some are really identified, they don't identify themselves as feminists, others really don't, and they use a very different language for what they want, what their goals are, how they think about themselves. And it really made me think very carefully about what freedom looks like for those women, right? And I don't think it's the kind of liberation that Betty Friedan was talking about, or Kate Millett, right? Or even someone like Judith Butler. But I think, you know, Judith Butler comes a little closer. So I was just really interested in those experiences made me think a lot about how kind of secular liberal feminist set of assumptions might really lead us astray when we're looking at all kinds of different contexts, but definitely the pre-modern context. In the book, I was really interested in critically examining that lens, that liberal secular feminist lens, and especially in Buddhist studies. So I think in some ways, we hadn't, as Buddhism scholars, hadn't examined that question as carefully as maybe we could. So I was interested in kind of making an intervention there. Not asking the question of whether ancient or medieval Buddhism is for or against women, whether it's good for them or bad for them, whether it's inclusive, whether it's misogynist, but really asking the much more basic question, which is, what is a woman in pre-modern Indian Buddhism? What does it mean to be female? And how might that have impacted Buddhist women or Buddhist identity or Buddhist asceticism? So kind of just getting down to those deeper questions that I think you have to answer before you can ask, you know, other questions about freedom, about equality, and so forth.
I think that there was a really useful way of framing it, to ask the questions of how we should be thinking about what the role of women is and how the way we're thinking about it today might shape that in ways that aren't productive for looking at these pre-modern texts. In sort of contrasting sort of those Western notions and those non-Western or South Asian notions, I noted that in your first chapter, you start by talking about different kinds of metaphors for birth. And I wonder if you might say something about that and how these different metaphors contrast or how they do different work.
Yeah. So in the first chapter, I was trying to figure out a way to get this point across that I kind of felt in my bones, sort of, you know, it was, I really had this strong idea about it, but I was struggling to find a way to express it, which is this idea that, yeah, a lot of Indian Buddhist texts reference birth, and they mention that birth is a form of suffering, but that in my view, I came to see it as a much deeper idea. And it's actually a really foundational idea, concept that structured a lot of other ideas in Indian Buddhism. And of course, some of this is coming out of my text, which is this kind of flamboyant, lengthy description of the birth process. But I really came to see my text as really being a kind of, you know, particularly lush, full treatment of what's a absolutely central theme in Indian Buddhism, which is the idea that birth is suffering. And obviously that idea has a big impact on gender, on how women are conceptualized, on what kinds of freedoms might be available to them, et cetera. So I was trying to figure out a way to say this without just saying it over and over again. And I came across this book by LaCoffin Johnson, which is kind of a famous philosophy book, called The Metaphors We Live By. And it talks about the idea of metaphor in this way that I found so helpful. So they talk about metaphor as being not a figure of speech, but really a kind of a logic, a way of thinking. So the idea is that when we use metaphor, it structures our conceptualization of an experience. It kind of guides our experience itself, the kinds of emotions that come up. And so it's very productive, right? And it's it's a very deep connection between the metaphor and our understanding and experience. So it's constructive. So this idea seemed to really fit. So just as an example of what they're talking about, they use the example of the metaphor that argument is war. So argument is like war. And the way they talk about it is that, yeah, we all know that arguments are not actually wars. You know, no one's actually slinging bullets or whatever. But we tend to go about arguing in a way that is warlike, and we often will have some of the same emotions, right? Our kind of our color rises and our voice gets louder and we maybe feel aggressive. So there's a way in which that metaphor is really structuring of that experience. So I thought that this was a really good way to think about the relationship between birth and suffering in this tradition, that it's a kind of foundational structuring metaphor that it's not so much that birth is an example of suffering, but rather that in these texts, and I argue that in Indian Buddhism in general, suffering is really actually conceptualized in terms of the birth process. And by that, I don't mean birth in this kind of broad metaphysical sense of phenomena arising in the world, but I actually mean birth from the body of a woman. And that again and again in this tradition, suffering will be referenced that way, understood that way, described in those terms. Yeah, so that was sort of chapter one of the book.
Right. And I thought it was interesting that you contrasted this with, you know, so this idea that birth is suffering with the, what you talk about is the Western idea that birth is creation. And I don't know if you would want to say a little bit more about the contrast that you see between these two.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I think that that is a more intuitive and a more common way that birth is used as a metaphor, right? And I talked about that in the Vedic tradition, right? So that creation stories in the Vedic tradition sometimes use the metaphor of sexual reproduction, right, and birth to describe the creation of the world. And that's a kind of more intuitive, I think, much more common way that birth is used as a metaphor in religious context. But in the Buddhist context, it actually isn't used in that way. Birth is used as not as a metaphor for creation of the world, but as a metaphor for suffering. And suffering itself is kind of closely connected to the arising of phenomena and the creation of the world. So there's a kind of middle step there, right? Suffering kind of gets inserted.
So you proceed from that to talk about, in the second chapter, positioning the descent of the embryo scripture within Avadana literature. Could you explain that connection for us?
Yeah, so it actually is a text historical connection, partly because the Garbha of Akranti Sutra it's located in a bunch of different places, actually, in the collections of texts that we have. But one of the places that it's located is in the Mular Savastivada Vinaya. And it's an interpolation. It's sort of stuck in there. It's not really integrated in any real way with the legal texts that are in there. And it is the embryological section of the text, which describes birth, is actually nested within a story. And the story is about Nanda, who is the Buddha's half-brother or cousin brother, who is in love with his wife, Sundari. He's sort of fabulously handsome and has everything going for him. He's rich. He's, you know, got this great marriage. And he is not that interested in ordaining to become a monk. And so the story is all about how it's a very well-known story. And it's all about how the Buddha kind of persuades him to become a monk. And in my text, the final kind of step in that process is that the Buddha teaches Nanda the Garbha of Akranti Sutra. So that's the teaching that he gives him at the final stage of finally convincing this really recalcitrant person that it's better to enter the monastic life. So, I mean, and I also argue in that chapter that so obviously the Nanda text itself is an Avadana, right? It's a story about virtue. I also argue that the Garbha of Akranti itself is a kind of epic. It's a sort of fetal epic. It tells a kind of dramatic story about you know, good and bad actions and the outcomes. So it really actually could be considered to be an avadana in a sense. So in terms of content, the Garbha Avakranti, both pieces of it, the Nanda frame story and then the embryological text itself, are kind of avadana-like. So I talk about that. But they're also, the Mula Savastivada Vinaya is, as a large collection, very closely connected text historically to the avadana literature. So a lot of the avadanas that are pruned and put in collections like the Vyavadana and so forth are also found in the Mula Savastivada Vinaya. So there's definitely a kind of just a genre connection there as well.
So I love the term fetal epic. So you position it in that context, but you also talk in this chapter about embryologies. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about how the descent of the embryo scripture differs from other accounts of the growth of the embryo in this South Asian context.
Yeah, it's really interesting to compare it. So the most obvious comparison or difference, I would say, is that the Garbha Avakranti is really the only embryological text which tells the story of embryological development week by week. So there are other stories, there are other accounts of that process which are either not kind of divided up into chunks of time, right? Or tell the story month by month, which is what the Ayurvedic texts do. So it's different in that sense. It's just, it stands out, right? It's obviously a different tradition. It's not just taking, for instance, the medical classics from India and kind of transposing them into a Buddhist context. It's quite a different tradition in that sense. It also, though, and it has a lot more detail, but it also is different in the sense that, especially if you compare it to the Ayurvedic accounts of the growth of the fetus in the womb, those accounts are much more concerned with the experience of the mother and with her state of health and how that can be promoted. And there's a much stronger sense of the connection between the fetus and the mother. So you have this idea of two-heartedness, it's called, right? That the mother and the fetus are connected by all of these channels, and the nutrients are going back and forth, but also all kinds of emotions and mental states are kind of communicated in the sort of interconnecting channels. And so there's this tradition, and the medical text talks about it, that you really must satisfy the cravings, the whims. You have to keep pregnant women happy in order to keep the fetus healthy. And there's a sense kind of that they're in it together. Whereas in the Garbha Avakranti, the fetus is on his own and the mother is very much the antagonist. So it's a kind of pitched battle. Mainly the aggression goes one direction from the mother to the fetus. There are descriptions of the things that the mother does, very ordinary things, just things that she eats, or just she lies down, she sits, she stands, she runs, very, you know, unavoidable parts of daily life that torture the fetus. They have the very painful effect on the fetus. And there's absolutely no sense of this kind of back and forth connection. And there's also very little attention paid in the text to the health of the mother. So that's just simply off the table. That's really not something the text concerns itself with. It's really not even, it's mentioned maybe once. There's a very brief reference to, oh yeah, and if the child dies and has to be cut out of the mother, it's painful for the mother too. But that's pretty much the only reference to maternal suffering. It's all about the fetus suffering.
Right. I'm wondering, you noted that this is a really detailed text. Is there one detail that you thought that kind of jumped out at you when you were reading this that you thought, oh, you know, this is something that is really striking and really tells us something about how the embryo is understood in this context?
I mean, I think all the details put together do that. I mean, one of my favorite images from the text, I'm not sure if this actually does what you were looking for, but there's this image early on. I think it's week. I don't know. It's like week 7 or something, where the fetus is described as a cluster of bubbles or a cluster of pearls. And so it's very early in the embryological development. And then there's another, I think it might be right after that, where the fetus is described as being blown up like a balloon. So he's sort of, you know, the structures are kind of formed, and then the fetus is kind of blown up. The karmic winds sort of blow the fetus up, and you sort of have this image of this balloon-like fetus kind of bumping around the womb. It's just a lot of really wonderful details like that. A lot of very evocative imagery. Speaking of metaphors, right? It's a highly metaphorical text. A lot of figurative language is brought in to try to get across what it's like for the fetus and what's happening in the womb.
Right. It's a perspective we don't really think about. And, you know, you've made the point very clearly in the book that this is not a pleasant experience for the fetus or for the embryo. And then in the next chapter, in chapter 3, you turn to the aesthetics of disgust. And this is really a fascinating chapter. And I wonder if you might explain how this aesthetics of disgust helps us understand both the context of this text and the text itself.
Yeah, so this was one of my favorite chapters to write and one of the ones I'm the most proud of. I'm not sure if it's, you know, merits my pride in it, but So obviously, yes, there's a lot of disgust language in the text. There's a lot of talk of fetal, of the impurities of the female body. It's very lush language, lots of kind of oozing fluids and pus filled this is and that. Like I said, there's a very rich use of language in the text. It's not a kind of dry description. So one of the, this really got my attention. And anyone who's looked at kind of parallel passages in other Buddhist texts about the female body knows what I'm talking about, that it's a kind of poetry. You know, it sort of can get so over the top. And so I got really interested in this, sort of why. You know, it's one thing to make the point that the fetus is suffering for whatever reason you're making that point, and that, you know, the womb is not a nice place to be, but to kind of lovingly dwell on it for line after line after line, and then to do it again, right, in the next, you know, in the next folio, and then to do it again and to do it 5 times in a row, it gets your attention. So I started thinking about disgust as a kind of aesthetic trope, as something. So it became clear to me that this was a kind of aesthetic use of language. It wasn't merely philosophical, didactic, right? It wasn't, therefore, you know, be a good monk, right? Or something. That it was, there was really something being evoked, a kind of aesthetic response from the auditor or the reader. So I started looking around at what other people have said about disgust in South Asia, but also in general, and I found this sort of treasure trove of disgust theory. It's so fascinating to read, both from the from the West, from kind of Euro-American theory, and then also really fascinating things said about the disgust, the bibhatsa rasa, right? The mood of disgust in the Sanskrit poetic tradition. And when I looked into this, I realized that there is something to be said about these disgust tropes, that there is a way to read it in which you really give due credit or due respect to the fact that these texts are trying to get a reaction out of us. You know, I call it a vomitive response, right? They're trying to get a rise out of us, literally. And that this is not something that this actually is part of a kind of aestheticized experience, which I think has a role in refining the mind, kind of, I use the word softening, kind of softening the mind, so that it's more ready to receive, hard lessons about the true nature of the world. So that's what I attempt to do in chapter 3. And of course, it has a lot to do with gender too, because there are different disgust tropes in Buddhism. So there's disgust language associated with eating, right? And the digestive processes, there's disgust language connected to the rotting cadavers, right? Death and corpses. There's disgust language associated with the sexualized female body. And then, you know, the text that I looked at, the Garbha of Kranti Sutra, is a clear example of disgust language for the mother, for the maternal, the reproductive body.
Yeah, so that mother is, you know, the key figure or one of the key figures for the text. And then in the next chapter, in chapter 4, you title it The Inauspicious Mother, which, of course, you know, jumped out at me because we don't obviously think of mothers usually as inauspicious, right? That this is a moment, you know, as someone's becoming a mother, of sort of great joy and delight. To have that sort of pegged with inauspiciousness immediately, you know, attracted my attention. And I would like to hear you explain how the figure of the mother is portrayed as inauspicious in the Buddhist context.
This chapter, I think, is in some ways kind of the core of the whole book. It's certainly the longest chapter, So in traditional South Asia, the mother is certainly not inauspicious. In fact, she's the embodiment of everything auspicious. So auspiciousness, and I had to do some kind of, I don't know what to call it. I had to do some real work to come up with a kind of cogent description of definition of what I meant by auspiciousness in the South Asian context, because there actually hasn't been a lot of work done on this in the pre-modern context. There's been a lot of work done on it, but it's all by kind of anthropology in the 20th century, basically. So I did very carefully use that work as a way to understand the pre-modern context, but tried to make it clear that I wasn't simply willy-nilly projecting backwards. I think many of what these anthropologists are saying about auspiciousness in, you know, modern or contemporary South Asia also applies. So what they say basically is that auspiciousness is associated with, especially with a lot of things, but in terms of women, it's associated with youth, with fertility, with sexuality, and with beauty, but also that it's cyclical, right? So, it's changeable. And so, for instance, women get old, right? Women go through menopause. They are no longer fertile. Women cycle in and out of auspiciousness. And so it's not something that defines every woman at every moment of her life. So birth is definitely something which in traditional South Asian ritual context is associated with birth most of the time. So birth is sort of, it's impure. So there's a lot of impurity associated with birth, but it is auspicious in the sense that it is the creation of new life. And it's associated with fertility, with sexuality. So it's definitely kind of coded auspicious. In a lot of Buddhist contexts as well, and I talk about some of the images that from the classical period where there's, you know, that some of the images of kind of fertile, beautiful yakshis on, you know, at Buddhist sites, who are definitely kind of the embodiment of auspiciousness. So you see this kind of idea also in Buddhist contexts, and you also see it in Buddhist literature. But you also see this other thing, which I started to really think about when I was reading the Garbha of Kranti Sutra. And the Garbha of Kranti Sutra, what it does is, because it talks about birth in this particular kind of way as an experience of torture, as a very dangerous thing, as something which is disgusting and impure and incredibly violent and painful, right? There's a kind of telescoping of birth and death in the Garbha of Kranti Sutra. And it seemed very obvious to me in reading the sutra that birth was being taken out of the category of the auspicious, right? So it was still impure, but now it was inauspicious and impure. And, you know, of course, it goes along with this idea of birth as being kind of the metaphor for suffering. So, you know, that's not all that surprising considering the nature of the text, but the thing that is really interesting is if you look at hagiographies, if you look at stories and narratives of the Buddha's birth, it turns out, or at least in my reading, that in those texts as well, birth is not auspicious. So even the kind of exemplary, perfect birth of the Buddha, it also is kind of taken out of the category of auspiciousness. It's not inauspicious, but it's not auspicious. And I read those texts very closely, and the kinds of things that I notice that which lead me to say that are, for instance, there's no kind of interchange between Maya and the Bodhisattva, right? So he's in the womb, but in these texts, he's not really dependent on her. So she is not providing nourishment. He is kind of dwelling there without really being affected by her, in a sense. It's very punctual, right? So he's conceived at this particular time, and then he's born exactly 10 months later. So there's none of the kind of unpredictability and cyclicality of auspiciousness. And then also the sexuality is really in question here. So in many of the accounts of the Buddha's birth, there's no sexual contact between his parents at his conception. And either that's made very clear or it's a bit vague, but there is a kind of effort to desexualize, right? So in many ways, I think the birth of the Buddha, that really kind of iconic story of the good birth, right? The desirable one, the one that is the exemplar, it is not auspicious. It's pure, but it's not auspicious. So there's a lot of implications of this. The main one is that if women are either inauspicious or in the best of all possible circumstances, neither auspicious nor inauspicious, for instance, in the case of Maya, right? And obviously she's way exceptional. If that's the case, then there's no value in that role, in a sense. There's a way in which it gives another option to women and men, but especially to women, right? To imagine other kinds of lives, which are other kinds of ways of being feminine, which are not defined by this really sort of central, coveted, cherished quality of auspiciousness. So that's kind of what the chapter tries to say.
Right. And I thought your reading of the birth of the Buddha was really effective in this context. And I liked also the way in which you talk about how these images of fertility also show up in monastic contexts, which is something that you turn to in chapter 5, how then these tales of monks or ascetics negotiated rituals and practices around fertility. So I wonder if you could expand on that.
Yeah, so one of the implications of the Buddhist discourse of birth, which I'm describing, is that because birth is so important for understanding suffering, and because there's so much written about birth, and again, I'm not talking about sort of the abstract arising of phenomena, but I'm talking about actual birth from the body of a woman. Ironically, monks end up knowing quite a bit about it. And they also because part of the way that the enlightened state is defined in this context is that it's defined as having mastery over the birth process, right? Ultimately being able to avoid it altogether. That means that beings who are on the path to enlightenment, who have made some progress, are perceived as having some control over the birth process. And ironically, what that amounts to is they can perhaps put a stop to it for themselves. Perhaps it also means that they can help someone else kind of get it going, right? So, and that kind of possibility is borne out in narrative traditions in Indian Buddhist texts. So, for instance, you have stories about sort of prenatal ordination of children. So I call them child pledging stories, right? So infertile couples who will invite a monk, usually a sort of famous monk, right, to come to their home, and they pledge their child, they pledge any child that might be born to them to be the monastic attendant of that monk. So they basically say, you know, please help us conceive a child. And if a child is born to us, we will, at a certain age, and it's usually 7 years of age, we will give this child to you to join the monastery, to become a novice monk and to be your monastic attendant. And so there's this, you know, there's this kind of real irony that these Buddhist adepts who are described as being celibate and they're, you know, have nothing to do with all this kind of nasty household business of childbearing are being asked to interfere in the process. And there's a bunch of other examples of similar kinds of interpenetration, shall we say, of fertility practices and monastic contexts. And so that's what chapter five is about. And the point that I also make, it's partly sort of documenting that phenomena, but it's also another point that I make that's pretty important is that the narrative descriptions of these practices, of these interactions, these lay monastic interactions, to me, to my ear, they make it pretty clear that there's a kind of shrugging off of this association. They're also the monks are make wry comments, right? Or they kind of say denigrating things about the whole process, and they kind of make it clear that they would rather not be involved. So there, it's this kind of, I don't know, on the one hand, you know, participating in something which is probably quite useful to monastic communities in terms of lay support and so forth. But, you know, at the same time, kind of putting a spin on it, right? That, well, we shouldn't really be doing this and we don't want to really be doing this. And we kind of wish these lay people would stop asking us to do this.
So, yeah, it's very interesting the way that they have to negotiate these kind of outside demands with what they see their role as being. And then in chapter six, you, in some ways, those issues are taken up when you turn to talk about female monastics and Buddhist nuns, that these kind of competing demands of, you know, maybe a secular notion of what women were and then a Buddhist notion of what women were. So could you talk about how you see the identity of these female monastics as shaped by the discourse around female bodies and birth?
This was a concern of this chapter, and actually is a concern of research that I'm heading towards now after finishing the book. So in this chapter, I try to get a better handle on the idea of impurity and impurity language in Indian Buddhism. There's a kind of scholarly trope that Buddhists weren't really concerned about purity, and that when it seems like they're talking about purity, really they're just kind of being infected by sort of Brahmanic norms. And I always was pretty questioning of that, because it seemed pretty obvious to me, clear to me, that in Indian Buddhist texts, you could see a kind of real commitment to the language of purity. So I was really interested in figuring out what the logic of that is, right? What did Indian Buddhists, how did they use the language of purity and purity? And obviously, it comes up a lot around menstruation and reproduction and women's bodies. I used Mary Douglas, actually, kind of classic theory of purity and pollution, to connect different types of purity talk that I noticed in Indian Buddhist sources two different social environments. And without going into the details, basically kind of Vedic Hindu context, which would be applicable to a lot of probably lay Buddhists, right, who would be still kind of conversant with those types of ritual traditions. You have a type of purity talk in which the impurity of women is at the same time considered to be very ritually powerful. So it's kind of ambivalent. And then you have the Garbha Avakranti Sutra is part of this type of purity talk, which is extremely fierce, extremely negative, which really sort of abominates impurity, female impurity, and obviously connected to an environment, a kind of ascetic environment in which women are completely excluded. So the Brahmin context, women are kind of incorporated. They're very important to that social context, but they have to be policed. But in the ascetic context, Buddhist ascetic context, women are completely, excluded and purity associated with the female body is, or impurity associated with the female body is sort of abominated. And the Garbha Avakranti Sutra is a very clear example of that. But then I went and I looked at menstrual texts in Buddhist Vinaya. And so I looked to see what Buddhist Vinaya has to say about menstruation. So, menstrual texts in the Brahmin legal tradition is a really good place to learn about purity and impurity in that tradition. So I thought, well, let's look in the Buddhist legal tradition. And it was really, really interesting because what I found is that those texts about which are there to manage menstruation are in nuns' communities are actually really matter of fact. They're very, I describe them as sort of what's your middle school health teacher, how she or he talked to you about menstruation. Like they're like, you use this kind of cloth and this is when you do it. And, I'm kind of exaggerating, but basically they have a very different tone than these other impure texts, which are about female impurity. And, so what I got from that is that this is really a social environment in which no one was really that invested in policing women using this kind of language or these practices around impurity. That in a sense, the women were kind of on their own. They were kind of establishing practices according to their own lights, according to what they knew, according to what worked. And I found that really fascinating and really kind of unusual. Like you don't really see religious discussions of female blood that aren't sort of heavily symbolic, right? And really emotional. So, that really made me think about monastic environments for women in pre-modern India and how much women might have had some agency and how much they might have had some control over it. So you asked me actually about how these women had to negotiate, right, with the kind of broader social environment. And that's the way in which the menstrual rules are complicated, because the menstrual rules are, it makes, the lawyers were very clear that women had to not offend the lay people. And so to the extent that there are kind of restrictions on women, like you can't go wash your menstrual cloths in the common bathing area, or washing area with everybody else. So those kinds of rules are there. So to the extent that there are kind of restrictions on women around menstruation, it has to do only with that, only with what the lay people, with what people outside the community will think, right, about not offending those people. But it's not a kind of internal, kind of heavy symbolic language about how terrible female blood is. That's just kind of not there.
So, Amy, I want to take what you've discussed in this chapter 6 and ask you if you can tie this back to chapter 4, where you talked about the inauspicious mother and how this opened up a different kind of space for women.
That's really important, actually, that connection. So the overall, the kind of overarching argument of the book you know, the title of the book is The Suffering Fetus and Female Freedom, or the subtitle, I should say. So all of this, in my mind, has something to do with female freedom. You would think that looking at a text which has so many terrible things to say about the female body would have nothing to do with female freedom. But what I came to really think and really deeply looking into the context of this text, the environment of it, is that actually what this text is doing is, so it's taking birth out of the realm of auspiciousness, right? It's saying that it's never auspicious. It's inauspicious, or at best, neither auspicious nor inauspicious. It's saying that women are never cycling through purity. They're always impure, no matter what. And then, you know, if you think back to chapter 3, which is about the aesthetics of disgust, there's this idea that even the most nubile, young, beautiful, sexy woman is actually disgusting. I think taken all together, what we have here is we have this kind of systematic deconstruction of what were very, very pervasive, important ideas about what it is to be a woman in pre-modern India. So what is it to be a woman? Well, a woman is auspicious, right? She participates in the miraculous creation of babies. A woman is sexualized and beautiful, at least when she's young, right? She's desirable as a sexual object. And finally, she is someone who by nature cycles through purity and impurity. That's so kind of such a key idea of what it is to be a woman in that context. And in the Buddhist context, you know, especially through the lens of this metaphor of birth, all of that gets kind of picked apart, deconstructed. So you'd think again, like, oh, well, that's great. So, you know, women, what do they have left? Well, that's sort of my point, is that instead of these very, very kind of heavy moral symbolic ideas about what it is to be a woman, right, the female embodiment, what it means, instead what you have is this kind of blank, not blank, but this kind of empty space, kind of capacious new space, moral, psychological space that monastic women could potentially use to define their femaleness in some other way, not in this way that they had been surrounded by, and are, you know, frankly, are still surrounded by, but at least within the four walls of the nunnery, right, within the kind of discursive space of Buddhism, they could define femaleness differently.
I think you did this really effectively in the book, and I really enjoyed reading it. And I'm really appreciative of all the time you've taken to talk about this book with us. So I wanted to ask one final question, and that's to pivot to what you're doing next. I'm wondering if you could spend a few moments telling us what your new project is, and if there are any themes that you're picking up from this book and carrying forward.
Yes, there are, in fact. So I have a couple new projects which are all interconnected with each other and then also very much connected to the Birth and Buddhism project. One of them is I got very interested in Vinaya literature while doing the Birth and Buddhism project. And in particular, I got interested in this in one Bhikshuni Vinaya that's written in a form of Buddhist Sanskrit. And it's not all that well known. But it's an amazing text because it's a kind of complete standalone Bhikshuni Vinaya in an Indic language. So I don't know if listeners may or may not know this, but Vinaya is an incredibly rich literature. It's really humorous, full of stories. And it also contains this kind of fascinating legal argumentation, which seems to reveal so much about the kind of deep logic of these communities, right? So that text is very near and dear to me, and I'm really interested in, it's a translation project. It's also a kind of analysis project. And I'm particularly interested in looking at the issues of agency. So I'm interested in looking at this text as a way to think about whether or not, there's some kind of female ascetic agency that is detectable there? And I think actually the answer is yes. So that's one project. Another project, which is linked to the textual project, is actually an ethnographic project, which is a completely new methodology for me. So, but it does connect back to where we started, which is kind of paying attention to contemporary nuns movement. So, I'm really interested in what sorts of lives Buddhist monastic women live, how they think about them, what kinds of forms of freedom are available to girls and women through monastic institutions that they can't locate elsewhere. And so I've identified a couple of communities and started to learn about them. And these are actually small communities. They're kind of, I don't know what's the right word. I mean, they're kind of on the fringe of things. They're not, you know, big nuns communities that are attached to a really big monastery. So one of them is actually in Lumbini, Nepal, and it's the girls there are... they don't shave their heads. They wear robes. They don't shave their heads. And they're all high school age or younger. And they live together as a monastic community. And the function of the community, among other things, is to kind of give them moral cover so they can continue to go to high school. Because otherwise their families would probably pull them out because there are worries about their virtue and being out in the world in that way. So that's just one example. So that's a kind of linked project. And I'm picturing, I think, both of those focuses in one book, probably, about female Buddhist ascetic agency and freedom, sort of past and present.
Yeah, that sounds like two great projects. And I really look forward to reading what comes out of it. I want to thank you for being on the show today, for taking time to speak with us, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
I really enjoyed it too. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay, take care and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to New Books in Buddhist Studies. We've been talking with Amy Paris Langenberg about her book, Birth in Buddhism, The Suffering Fetus and Female Freedom, and you can find a link on our website. Until next time, goodbye.